Alan?
Thank you, Dave. I want to set the scene for you just a minute. Think back to the early spring of 1973. You can do it. Maybe too recent for some. Watergate was breaking. Ferdinand Marcos had declared martial law in the Philippines. And Cuban and Soviet infiltrators had fueled insurgencies all over the underdeveloped world. All those insurgencies had initials for their names. But the biggest story of the day in spring of 1973 was unfolding at Clark Air Base in the Philippines, a U.S. air base near Angeles City on the island of Luzon, where a large group of some of the best newspaper, magazine, and TV reporters from all over the free world were gathering to recover the return of the prisoners of war from Hanoi, the so-called Hanoi Hilton, a vile torture chamber, really. Many of those POWs had been tortured nearly to death, names like Stockdale, Reisner, and John McCain. In those days, print stories were sent by then called high speed, but by today's standards, very slow speed wire, Eastern Union, and television film was sent by air to Tokyo and then on to New York. There was no internet. There were very few satellite phones, if any, I can't remember. And most everyone read at least one daily newspaper and watched one of the three major networks' TV news programs. Well, those hundreds of reporters in the Philippines at that time, from everywhere, formed their own initial insurgency called SWAPO, Stymied Writers and Photographers Organization. And I'm proud to say that I and our speaker were two very prominent members of that group. But something very miraculous happened. When those POWs returned on those C-141s, landing at that airbase and getting off that airplane on their feet, even though hobbled and crippled and tortured and emaciated, and insisted on coming down those stairs and saluting the four-star Commander-in-Chief Pacific, every single one of us had tears flowing out of our eyes and onto our notes. And I think our speaker would say that that may have been the biggest story he ever covered. And we're talking about someone who's 40-some years as a Washington reporter, the last 15 years as the Washington Bureau Chief of the New York Daily News. He's now breaking in, I think he said, in his 15th year. He's breaking in his 7th, 8th, or 9th editor. It's kind of hard to remember. He's also breaking in his 8th president. And maybe 9 if you count the trips he made with LBJ. In 2007, he wrote a New York Times bestseller, Write It When I'm Gone, which was a phenomenal book about his many, many off-the-record interviews with Gerald Ford throughout his career. If you haven't read it, get it. He's seen one presidential resignation, at least 3 assassination attempts, 2 he witnessed personally against President Ford, and you remember the Reagan assassination attempt. He's covered 1 impeachment, President Clinton. He's made 16 U.S.-Soviet-Russian summits. He's been to all 50 states. He's traveled with presidents to 48 countries. He's former president of the White House Correspondents Association. He's won every major award given by that group. You've seen him on Meet the Press, Face the Nation, Hardball, Larry King, Beltway Boys, Fox and Friends, Washington Week in Review, Fox, Charlie Rose, it goes on and on. I am very proud to present my friend, Tom DeFrank.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you, Alan, very much for the oversized introduction. I appreciate it very much, but I have to say that every time I get an introduction like that, I'm reminded that I have covered some pretty oversized egos over the last parts of 6 decades. Don Rumsfeld, Rudy Giuliani, John Sununu, Alexander Haig, James Schlesinger. And I suspect if any of them were here today, they would probably say something like, "That's an introduction I so rarely receive and so richly deserve." But I don't, and I know I don't, and if I thought for a moment that I deserved it, my very dear friends Phil and Pat Jones here would set me straight. I am always happy to come to Southwest Florida. This is a wonderful place. This is the first, Naples is the first place my wife and I came 2 weeks after we were married. We stayed at the Ritz-Carlton, and I love this part of the world. But I must confess that the real draw today is not Naples. It's my dear friends Phil and Pat who are here. And Phil and I have covered many things. We covered the Gerald Ford vice presidential days, a momentous time for America. And we have many stories. Several of them can't be repeated in large groups. But however, Pat Jones knows all of them anyway. So ask her if you're curious. But I'm really thrilled that they're here, and I'm thrilled to be here. I appreciate the invitation. And I'm going to talk a little bit, not too long, about what I do for a living. Cover the White House, which I still do, even though I've got a lot of administrative stuff to do as well. But I still spend at least 3 days a week at the White House. I'm going to tell a few stories, and I'm going to mainly talk about election 2012, and then I'm going to save some time for questions. And I encourage you not to be bashful about questions. One of the things I don't like about a business that I really do love is that we in the press are good at dishing it out, and sometimes we're not so good about taking it. But I've done this a long time, and I think I can take it. So if you have a question that might even be, let's say, borderline rude, don't be bashful. I don't mind. Now, I always like to start with a little good news. One of the reasons for that is that most people don't expect that from reporters, good news. I'm always reminded about something Jimmy Carter said at an off-the-record dinner with reporters on New Year's Eve 1980 in Plains, Georgia, just 3 weeks before he left office. I was a little neurotic at the time because I'd covered Carter, and I'd only spent a week with Reagan. So when Reagan won, I thought I was really behind the curve. So I passed up Carter's final trip to Georgia as president to spend a little time with President-elect Reagan. So I missed this off-the-record dinner, and since I wasn't there, I'm not bound by the off-the-record rule. I can tell you what happened. What happened is that just a little bit before midnight, President Carter got up and offered a toast, and he said, "I wish two things for Ronald Reagan, my successor. I wish him Menachem Begin and the Israelis, and I wish him Sam Donaldson and all the rest of you jerks in the press." Like my college roommate, who is a lawyer in El Paso, likes to say, y'all's motto in the media is very simple. If you don't have anything nice to say, let's hear it. I don't buy that. I suspect 95% of you buy that, but I don't buy that. But I understand why 95% of America feels that way about the media. So I start with a little good news, and here's my good news. Whatever your politics, whatever you think about the last election, this election, I think it should be clear to all of you by now that we have a real leader of strength and determination and resolve at the head of our government. But Alan didn't ask me to talk about Hillary Clinton, so maybe a little later, and depending on where your questions go. I want a detour here. I want to do a short detour down memory lane, but before I do that, I want to congratulate the student speakers today. They all did a really fine job. I was thinking about this the other day. I was trying to track down my high school journalism teacher, and I knew her closest friend was my high school speech teacher in Arlington, Texas, where I'm from. I got her. My journalism teacher has an unlisted number. I knew she lived somewhere in Colorado, but I found my speech teacher who gave me the unlisted number, and we were reminiscing about how hard it was for a 14-year-old to give speeches in those days. And I just want to say I thought you all did really, really well, and you should all be congratulated. It gets easier as you go on, I promise you. Alan has already stolen my thunder. I wanted to give you a couple of quick detours here. I'm often asked two questions. The first is always, what is your greatest story? And I suspect that most people looking at my biography, my resume, I should say, would probably think the resignation of Nixon is the greatest story. And it is true that I was on the South Lawn of the White House on Friday, August the 9th, 1974, covering that. I was the magazine pool reporter for the Nixon departure that day. It was an extraordinary day, but that is not the greatest story that I have covered. Alan has told you what it was. It was February 12, 1973, at Clark Air Base in the Philippines. Anybody who was there that day got a refresher course in the resilience of the human spirit. Because as Alan has told you, these guys were broken in body, horribly broken, but not at all broken in spirit. It was a privilege to be there. And no other story I've ever covered, and I'm sure no other story that I will ever cover, had the dramatic impact and just the power. The power of the moment is something that's just burned into my brain. That was quite something. Second question I always get is, well, who's your favorite president? I say, not my job to have president, to have favorite presidents. I should say to you now, since I know most of you are Obama, you're not thrilled with him, but I should say to you, not my job to have favorites. I don't love presidents. I don't loathe them. I cover them, and it's different. That's a big difference. I'm a registered independent. I cover the presidency kind of as a horse race, who's up, who's down, who's doing well, who's doing poorly. Same way I cover elections, which are much the same dynamic. So I don't have a favorite president. I will say the president that I enjoyed covering the most was Gerald Ford, but not when he was president. Phil will tell you that was not as much fun. Hurtling around the country with him as vice president right in the middle of Watergate on a twin-engine prop jet that was so slow we called it Slingshot Airways was quite a time. That airplane, by the way, is still flying. It's owned by the government of Canada, and it fights forest fires in the province of Saskatchewan. And hopefully one of these days I will get up there to take a look at it. They've stripped out all the seats. It's empty except for this huge belly tank. But there's a little plaque in there that tells you that was Air Force Two at one time. As a matter of fact, it was Air Force One once when Richard Nixon was flying in someplace in West Virginia with a runway too small for a bigger airplane. So that's a historic airplane, but it was a historic, momentous time, terrible time for the country, but an exhilarating time for a rookie reporter from a little town in Texas. That's the most fun I've ever had in journalism. So back from the flashback, let's fast forward to Obama and election 2012. He's been president long enough for you all to know what you like and don't like, what you think of him. Probably most of you know what you're going to do in terms of voting for him, or in your case, probably not. So I'm not going to give you a dissertation on Obama. You know what you think by now. I will say he's taller than you think. He's skinnier than you think. He's probably smarter than you think. And as all of you know, he's very much fighting for his political life these days. He's in serious trouble. Just look at the approval polls. Yes, they've gotten better, but the numbers are not great for presidents at this point in a presidency. The number of people who think the country's on the wrong track is at a number that is historically means you're going to lose. It's getting better, and I'll talk about that later. The other thing about Obama is he's a polarizing president. When I first got to Newsweek as an intern in June of 1968, almost 44 years ago, one of our former bureau chiefs who had covered the New Deal still had an office there. He's a wonderful man named Ken Crawford. And I was always struck by a letter he had on his wall from Roosevelt's first term. It must have been 33, 34, 35. It's from a Wall Street investment banker, and it said, "Dear Mr. Crawford," and it was handwritten in an angry scrawl. It said, "Dear Mr. Crawford, your columns remind me of that dirty, rotten, vicious, communist SOB, Franklin D. Roosevelt." I've been reading a wonderful book by David Brinkley that came out 20 years ago. I never got around to it, about Washington in wartime, and it was reminding me about just how polarizing a person Roosevelt was. You loved him or you loathed him, and I think that's much the same situation that Obama confronts right now. There's not a lot of middle ground with Barack Obama. You either really love him and or disappointed in him, or you really can't stand him. One of my former editors at Newsweek, a Vietnam vet named Bill Broyles, wrote about 6 months ago that Obama was the Neville Chamberlain of American politics, drifting towards national catastrophe one compromise at a time, a president who treats core American values as bargaining chips. Now, this is somebody who worked for Hillary Clinton and who wishes that Hillary had won, but that's a loyal Democrat saying those things. And some of you, I know, if you know anything about Texas politics, you know about a Democratic renegade called Kinky Friedman, who ran for governor a couple elections back, who recently said that he would vote for Charlie Sheen before he voted for Barack Obama. And these are ostensibly friends of President Obama. So he's got a lot of work to do to get reelected. Why does he confront all this trouble? Several reasons, of course. One is, I think, he misread his mandate. He thought the 2008 election was a mandate to move to the left. It wasn't. It was a mandate to get rid of Bush-Cheney. The country was tired of 8 years of Bush-Cheney, and they wanted a change. They didn't want to lurch to the left. They wanted to stay to the center. This is a center-right country politically, and Obama thought he had a mandate to move center-left, and he misread that mandate. I think problem number two is health care. It's definitely a missed blessing. Getting the health care reform bill passed is a monumental accomplishment. History will reward him. The problem is, it's a monumentally unpopular historic achievement for which he will not be rewarded in this election. Half the country, more than half the country, still doesn't like the health care bill, and it's a drag at the moment. It's not a plus, it's a minus. Another problem is the death of bipartisanship. I've never seen more poison in the political system than there is in Washington these days. Rick Perry was not a great candidate, but he had a couple of wise things to say about the mess in Washington. It is a mess, and there's nobody willing to step up and say, "I don't have to stick it to the other guy. We ought to do something for the country every once in a while." And I find myself saying, at least once a week, "Where is Jerry Ford when we need him, or Bob Dole, or Tip O'Neill, or Tom Daschle, or Trent Lott?" Politicians like this who were as partisan as they came when they needed to be, but also bipartisan when they knew it was in the national interest to be so. That's just not the case anymore. And then, of course, the other problem is the rise of the Internet. People can say anything on the Internet, allege anything, and there's no editor to say, "How do you know that's true? Have you checked that? Who told you that?" And stuff goes viral, whether it's true or not, and politicians are affected by that. And, of course, from a historical standpoint, Obama is in the unenviable situation of bucking history. No president has ever won re-election with unemployment above 8%. Nobody except Franklin D. Roosevelt, and I don't think he's in the Rooseveltian league. The other problem, of course, is the economy. It's still the economy. The economy has gotten better, which should be applauded by everybody, but it's still not a robust, booming economy. I've always said, presidents always get more blame or more credit for they deserve, and I think Obama, predictably and understandably, is being blamed for a lot of the economic perils that we see in the country. Now, the good news for Obama is that for a long time he's been running against a generic Republican. As a Democratic governor, I know, who likes to say at some point there will be an alternative not the Almighty. It was easy to say anybody but Obama when it was an abstract thought. Now you're going to have one guy versus Obama, and I think that will be Romney. Yes, the election is not over, but GOP elders think that Romney has the best chance of beating Obama. More to the point, I think, you can find very senior Republicans in Washington and around the country who will say, well, it doesn't look good for Romney right now, but even if he loses, he won't cost us the House or a shot at taking the Senate. If Gingrich or Santorum lead our ticket, we're doomed. Obama will win, we'll lose the House, we'll lose any chance of taking over the Senate. In other words, party leaders, they're reluctant to say it out loud because that's dangerous for them to do so, but they say it to people like me and to their families and others that Santorum or Gingrich, in their view, would be a real problem for the Republican Party. One of these guys who I've been dealing with since 1980, who is a Mandarin of the Republican Party, household name, highly revered, likes to say, Obama can't win, but we can lose. And his attitude is, we can lose if we nominate Santorum or Gingrich. So we will see how that works out. I still think all the odds favor Romney. So let's assume Romney wins just for the sake of argument at the moment. Romney's strengths, he's disciplined most days. He does have this tendency of saying very goofy, loopy things when you least expect that to happen, but he's more or less disciplined. He's a grown-up. I think he's run a better campaign this time than he ran last time. He definitely has managerial experience. Smooth debater most time. As I said earlier, he's preferred by Republican elites, and don't discount this, he's got very good presidential hair. Now, that's not enough. Rick Perry had very good presidential caliber hair, but that didn't save him. You got to remember what you're going to do as president, and he didn't. Romney has his weaknesses. The first is Romney care. Republican critics have been wrapping that around his neck for a long time. He does have a record, as everybody knows, of being somewhat elastic about his positions on things. They've changed over the years. And let me just say, whatever the defects of the Obama campaign might or might not be, they have a massive and superior opposition research team, and I would venture to say 80% of their best stuff, the stuff they think that will be more damaging to Romney than anything, they're still sitting on, waiting for the opportune moment to drop it. So there's a lot of stuff they're waiting on, but you'll see a lot more stuff starting Labor Day, I think. Stiff, inauthentic. I think he's an authentic person, but he cannot project authenticity. It's like my wife sometimes said, he reminds me of my first husband if I'd had one. On the other hand, that's what they said about Bush 41, and he was elected and turned out to be a pretty good president. We will have to see. But, you know, he has trouble relating to ordinary people, and his aides have tried to figure out ways to fix it. They haven't been able to fix it, and that is a problem. So, Romney, Obama, more likely than not. How does the winner win? It's pretty simple, I think. He's going to make it a referendum on the other guy, or try to. The Republicans say, if this is a referendum on Obama, he loses. And most of the time, that's the case. The Obama people say, no, elections are about the future, not the past. And we can make this about the future, not the past, and we can win. I'll come back to that in a second. So the Republicans will try to make it a referendum on Obama, a referendum on the economy, and you can be sure that Romney will be saying, or whoever their nominee is, he made it worse, we can do better. That'll be their basic strategy. Obama's strategy is one, doing the best I can, was left with a horrible legacy to have to deal with. He will demonize the Republicans of people as politicians who have gone out of their way not to be helpful for selfish partisan reasons. the basic, I think the fundamental calculation at the Obama White House, and we'll see in the next 8 months if they're right or not, the fundamental calculation is we can improve the economic trajectory, and as long as it's getting better, we can win. We will see. How much is better? I think if it's above 8% unemployment, Obama's got a good chance of losing. If it's under 8% unemployment, he has a good chance of winning. But it's too early to know. But I'll tell you one thing you can predict in the fall: no more hope and change. It's going to be slash and burn. As one of my best friends, who happens to be a Democratic consultant, says, I have won many elections with a horribly weak candidate by making the other guy the issue. You can be sure the Obama White House will try to make Romney the issue, just as Romney's campaign will try to make Obama in the last 4 years the issue. It comes down to electability versus intensity, style versus substance, pragmatism versus emotion. I still think the economy trumps all, and the argument will be a choice between two visions. GOP, as I said earlier, will say he made it worse, and it'll make it worse for another 4 years. Obama will say the future will be a disaster if the Republicans win because they want to take us back to the 1930s. We'll see. Now, as I said earlier, and you know, since you're very illiterate and intelligent folks, you see Obama's fortunes are improving. The economy's gotten better. Unemployment is coming down. Unemployment claims are going down. So he has an opening there. He also happens to be better in campaign mode than as a governing mode. One of his senior political advisors said to me the other day, and wished he hadn't, that he's a better campaigner than he is a president, so we're going to campaign. The Democratic base is starting to return. Many of them are very disappointed in Obama, but they have started to return, and independents, more to the point, independents are starting to turn away from Republicans, thanks to immigration and contraception. Issues that turn off the independents and moderates, the middle, the centrists in this country who almost always decide elections. They're not happy with the culture warriors of the Republican Party. A Republican strategist who I've also known for over 30 years likes to say, red meat is delicious in the primaries, it's indigestible in the general. He was talking about independents and moderates in the middle, so we'll see. There's no doubt the economy is getting better. There's been 24 months of private sector job growth, but it's still up for grabs. I didn't bring my electoral map. I should have, but Obama has more options in the Electoral College of winning than Romney. Here's just one. If Obama wins all the states that John Kerry won in 2004, plus Colorado, Nevada, and New Mexico, which Obama won last time, Obama wins with two votes to spare, and he doesn't have to win Florida or Ohio or North Carolina or Virginia. He still wins. However, I think there's a very good chance Obama will lose New Hampshire. Romney's very popular there. That was a Kerry state. So in this scenario, if Obama wins Colorado, Nevada, and New Mexico, and he loses New Hampshire, he loses by two electoral votes, 268. He's short. All I will say is if you look at the electoral map and math, he's got more firm or fairly firm electoral votes right now than Obama. That doesn't mean he's a shoe-in, far from it. Now, so the real question is, can Obama win? Or as I sometimes say, can he snatch victory from the jaws of defeat? Well, if this were a parliamentary system, he would no longer be president. President Biden would have delivered the last State of the Union address, and maybe even President Clinton, Hillary Clinton. But Obama is still standing. Can he win? Sure, of course he can win. Let's just think for a second about all the presidents who weren't. Tom Dewey, Ross Perot, Henry Clay, George McClellan, President Romney, George, not Mitch, President Gary Hart, and then one guy who actually was president and never made it, President Al Gore. One of my favorite... That's not an editorial comment. That's you're showing your whatever. I'm going to show you this very quickly because it's one of my favorite pictures. Phil and Pat know this picture. It's the cover of Newsweek, or I should say, this is the cover of Newsweek that would have run had Gerry Ford come back from the political dead. It's one of my favorite pictures. Actually, I've got a signed copy of that. And Ford, the day I asked him to sign it, wasn't too thrilled because the sting of defeat was still with him. It had only been 10 years since he had lost to Jimmy Carter. But he was not supposed to win, but he came very, very close. What I'm trying to say is the conventional wisdom is often always wrong. And I'm going to do a pop quiz. And now, Phil, you can't answer this because I know you know the question. Everybody knows the name of the president's airplane, Air Force One. But for about 3 years, not that long ago, the name was changed. Does anybody know what the name was? Cornish Small, you can't answer either if you know. Spirit of 76. And this is one of my favorite conventional wisdom stories. Nixon loved to talk about historic firsts. He always loved, and history has given him high marks for being the guy that opened the door to China. He was so pleased at the prospect of being president for the bicentennial on July 4th, 1976, that he changed the name of Air Force One to the Spirit of 76. And he painted it, those four magisterial words on either side of the front of the plane right below the cockpit. He changed the flight certificate. When reporters went on the airplane, you got flight certificates saying, this is to certify that Phil Jones has flown in the Spirit of 76 as a guest of Richard Nixon, President of the United States of America. I've said to my son, save all the Spirit of 76 stuff. It'll help with your college tuition fund. And then, of course, after a couple of years, then we all know what happened, which is my point. Nixon was gone by the bicentennial, and the bicentennial was presided over by Gerald Ford, a guy who had no aspirations to be president, who just wanted to be Speaker of the House. And I say this in a very kind way. He was an accidental president because he didn't expect to be. And yet, I think that's just a classic example of the conventional wisdom often being wrong. And then let's not forget President Hillary, who was supposed to be a mortal lock to beat Obama. And then I remember the day before the 2000 election, George W. Bush called a friend of his in San Antonio, and he was asked, how's it going? And then Governor Bush, said, my aides say it could be a landslide of Reagan-esque proportions. Well, we all know what that was. The landslide came down to, 537 or 547 disputed votes in this state and a one-vote margin in the Supreme Court. I know a little bit about the conventional wisdom being wrong. There's a guy I know pretty well who once said, I can't tell you who the next president will be, but I can tell you who the next president won't be, and it won't be Ronald Reagan. That was me in a speech. I was convinced by a White House aide that it was all about demographics. The country was getting younger every year, and he used to say, a youthful electorate won't vote for a 69-year-old guy with orange hair from California. He couldn't have been more wrong. I couldn't have been more wrong. So the conventional wisdom is almost always wrong, and we have 8 months to see how this sorts out. There's all kind of wild cards. Don't forget, things will happen that we can't entirely anticipate, and how those things unfold and are dealt with, we'll have a lot to say about who the next president is. We're going to get an early preview at the end of this month. Actually, the week after next, oral arguments are going to be heard in the Supreme Court over the health care bill. And by the end of May, or maybe in June, we will know whether Obama's mandate is unconstitutional. And whether the court upholds it or rejects it as unconstitutional, it's just going to remind the majority of the American people who don't like it why they don't like it. So that's going to hurt Obama in the fall, however it comes out. There's always a foreign crisis of some sort. I mean, if Obama had been luckier, he would have gotten Osama bin Laden in September or October. That was a monumental accomplishment, but it was a long time ago. Foreign crises will happen. Economic reversal, gas prices, they're very worried about gas prices in the White House. And, of course, I am old-fashioned enough to say people really don't get down to it till the debates. There's going to be three debates. The first one's in October, I believe, and I think A lot of people don't make up their mind until then. So what I'm really trying to say is, overnight is a lifetime in politics. I've learned that the hard way. Stay tuned. If the election had been 3 months ago, Obama was a goner. If the election were today, he'd probably win narrowly. We got 8 months to go. I think all I can say confidently now is Obama made history by getting himself reelected, and as of today, he'll have to make even bigger history to get himself reelected, but he would win today if the election were today. But don't believe any of this stuff you hear or read. It's going to be a close election. I'm betting 3 points in the national tally. So stay tuned. Overnight is a lifetime in politics. Let's do some questions. Dave, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We have a couple gifts we'd like you to take home with you. We have two books for you, one about Marco Island and the other about Naples, Florida. And I'll place them at your place here at the table and take them with you. You have one other great benefit. Whenever you decide to move here, if you ever retire, you can immediately jump our 387-person wait list and become a member of the Forum Club. So we look forward to welcome you as a member.
Alan.
Thank you, Dave. Alan. Anybody who has to leave, please feel comfortable in doing that. I appreciate you all being here. But if you have some questions, let's do some.
Well, I just want to show you, we got a lot of questions about Obama and a whole lot of questions about the news media. So let me start with a detail question. The press delved into all details of President George W. Bush's life, grades, friends, drinking at Yale, et cetera. Now, why hasn't the press delved into details of Obama's college life? Who were his friends, his grades, his writings, his travel? Why don't we know this?
With all due respect, that's ridiculous. What about Jeremiah Wright? What about Bill Ayers? Remember all of that from the last time around? What about this guy is obviously not born in the United States. He was probably born in Indonesia. I just disagree fundamentally. That's part of a larger question, but I get this all the time. It just depends on your point of view. I always get questions about why is the press so biased, and I have learned that basically if you don't agree, most people who have a problem with the press don't just, what am I trying to say? If the press writes something, the press, if the press writes something you don't agree with, there's a problem with the press. When I write something that people like, I get emails saying, this is wonderful, I've sent it to my whole list. Thank you for being fair and balanced. And when I write stuff that people don't like, there's only one explanation. Liberal, commie, pinko. You know. I'm sorry. People believe what they want to believe, and they should. God bless you. Everybody should believe what they want to believe. But for the most part, that's what happens. I did a lecture on a cruise ship about 6 years ago about George W. Bush, because I've known him a long time. And right afterwards, some lady from Tennessee came up and she said, I hope the next time you talk about our president, you don't trash him like you just did. And I was really taken aback. I thought she was way over the line. And so I went to my stateroom, got on the elevator, the door opened, and a guy saw me and he said, are you a publicist for George W. Bush? You should go on the payroll. You're in the tank for the guy. And so I wanted to say to both of them, were we at the same presentation? But I knew that would probably not be smart of me to say it. But that's what I was thinking. People make of what they want to make, and they believe what they want to believe, and that's fine by me.
Tom, if Governor Romney is the Republican candidate, who is the likely vice presidential candidate? Rubio, Christie?
I think Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio. Christie has said he's not ready to be president. So if he's not ready to be president, why should he be ready to be vice president? And also, I don't think Christie would bring New Jersey with him. It's such a Democratic state. It's the power of the unions. So I think it's somebody I really respect in the Republican Party says it's got to be a senator or governor or a former senator or governor who is more likable than Romney and more conservative than Romney. That's the template. That's the formula. And I think Rubio and Jeb Bush fit that because both of those very formidable politicians could bring Florida. I think Florida would be in the bag if either one of them was on the ticket on the Republican ticket.
There are a bunch of related questions here about the election. You've already talked a little bit about who you think the Republican candidate's going to be. You also spoke about President Obama misreading his mandate and winning the 08 election. Are the Republicans currently misreading their mandate? And secondly, are the Republicans damaging themselves and aiding the Democrats? And that's from a registered independent. And another related question, what about the majority of women? Are not the Republicans losing them with their positions on contraception and abortion?
Starting from the back, as I suggested earlier, contraception is an issue that is really turning off a lot of women, especially a lot of women who say that they are independent and moderate. They don't like the culture wars. So I think that is, I think that's absolutely right. Now, misreading the mandate, I think the mandate Republicans feel is most Republicans say we've got to get rid of Obama to save the country. The question is, how do you do that? And I think evangelicals and Tea Party activists feel like basically you've got to bust up the party to start over. But it doesn't matter what I think. It really doesn't matter what I think, but it matters what the people who run the Republican Party think. And as I said earlier, they think that Santorum or Gingrich will hand the White House to Barack Obama because Santorum and Gingrich are out of the political mainstream. It's not as bad as Goldwater, but there would be a problem. And again, I defer on this to Republican leaders who I have dealt with and trusted and who have never steered me wrong. And these are people who are passionate in their antipathy towards Obama. They are just desperate to see him sent back to Chicago to work on his memoirs. And these are people who say the worst thing that could happen for us is for Obama to be reelected, and for that to happen, it's going to be easier for that to happen if Santorum or Gingrich are our presidential nominee. Again, it doesn't matter what I think, it's what the party experts think. And I think after the Illinois primary next week, I think more and more of these elders will come forward and say, okay, we've done enough of this, it's time to heal up the wounds. Let's see.
We talked about vice presidential candidates for Republicans. What's the best gaffe you've heard from Joe Biden?
I can't remember one, but there have been plenty. He has a tendency for malaprops, but he's a pretty good vice president. He's a very effective vice president. He's now starting to be the attack dog that vice presidents have always been. But I don't have one that comes to mind, but I certainly would be the first to agree that he's entertaining because you never know when he's going to pop one out. He did have one the other day at a lunch for the British Prime Minister where he was saying, you know, my Irish grandfather would just be appalled if I were here with a British guy, and he looks at the ceiling and says it's gotten better, you know, with the British. And it wasn't a gaffe, but he's colorful and you never know what he's going to say. And for reporters, that's great. We love that.
I'm going to try to summarize what are probably 50 questions on the news media. Let me start with a very specific portion of that. Your thoughts on the New York Daily News switching from conservative to liberal, and what does that portend in their coverage?
It doesn't portend a damn thing about their coverage. You must be talking about the editorial page. Our owner, Mort Zuckerman, who hired me personally 15 and a half years ago, is an old-fashioned Democratic liberal. However, he's been extremely critical of President Obama. He has been very, very, very tough on Obama. And it'll be interesting to see who our paper endorses in the fall. I have no way of doing that, but all I can tell you is that in 15 years and 3 months, as the bureau chief of the New York Daily News, I have never been told, don't write this story, write this story. You've got to say this in a story. You can't say this in this story. Every newspaper has an editorial point of view on the editorial page. And as I said, nobody's ever sent that down to me. As a matter of fact, just to talk a little bit out of school here, I still take a little bit of heat from the White House because we have a conservative columnist who wrote a couple of years ago that when Michelle Obama took one of her daughters to Spain at government expense, this was just like Marie Antoinette. The White House was none too pleased, and I said, hey, that wasn't a news story. That was an opinion column on the editorial page, and that's opinion, not news. And they didn't see it that way at the White House. So if the tenor of that question is that the New York Daily News, which is now owned by a liberal Democrat, is in the tank for Obama, trust me, that is just not correct.
Tom, do you personally think newspapers will go out of business?
Well, there's a lot of newspapers, and all of them will not go out of business. I'm very fearful about print because I know a friend who reads 5 newspapers a day. He's in his mid-70s. His 20-year-old son reads the same 5 newspapers, but he reads them all on the Internet. He doesn't subscribe to any of them. And that's what's happening. And the other problem with print is you're locked into this overhead. You got to deliver your papers. Delivery costs, distribution costs, manufacturing costs, gasoline prices, all those things are built-in expenses. So I think some papers will do things like get rid of their Saturday edition and say to readers, we're going to have a bigger Sunday edition. I think print, newspaper print editions or a mature property, as one of my friends likes to call them. And they're under a lot of pressure, but I don't think that most of them will go out of business. I think they'll be smaller. They may miss some publication days of the week, but I think most people still want to have something in their hand. But it's a challenge. Print is in a challenging situation. There's no doubt about it.
Tom, we're running out of time, so I'm going to try, as much as I'd love to ask some of these great questions, we just don't have time. What hope is there for reducing the partisan, dysfunctional way our government operates? That's one future-related question. The second is, if Obama misread his 2008 mandate, what would you expect if he's reelected? And the third is, what is needed to recreate bipartisan rapport?
I'm very pessimistic about questions 1 and question 3. We need a whole new type of politician who's kind of like Mr. Smith goes to Washington, somebody who says, I'm not going to be a knee-jerk, lockstep Republican or Democrat. I'm going to go to Washington to try to do something. And if it means getting the debt under control, the budget under control, reducing entitlements, reducing federal spending, causing a lot of pain, even in my district, I'm going to do that because I owe that to my grandchildren. I don't see a lot of that in Washington. Actually, I see zero of that in Washington, and that really is—that's really troublesome to me. Second question: If Obama misread his mandate in 2008, what does he do if he wins it? All I can tell you is it all depends on whether the House and Senate are Republican or not. If Obama—and that's the great fear, as I said earlier—of Republican Party elders. If the Republicans lose the House, lose the chance to take over the Senate, and Obama is elected, it's going to be awfully hard to deny him. He will then see that as a mandate after 4 tough years to try to do some of the things he couldn't do the first 4 years. I tend to think that at least one body in the Congress will be Republican, so there will be some checks and balances, even if he wins. But he's going to have to, he's going to have to move to the middle because given the polarization of the process, he will not have all the votes he needs to do what he does. I think if Obama is reelected and even if he loses the Senate, Obama's not going to be able to get 60 votes for much of anything he wants to do. So he's going to have to move to the middle. And in the second Obama term, he would be looking for his legacy. And so he probably would be less moving to the left than some of you obviously fear. But again, it'll all depend on how much power Obama would have, and that comes down to the fact, one, he's got to get reelected, which is an open question, and two, it depends on who controls one or both houses of Congress.
Thank you very much, Tom. This has been great.
Thank you. That's
great. Thanks again. We'll see you in 2 weeks. 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Don't forget to turn in your name tags.
Thank you. I meant to ask you, where in Sweden are you from?